Today's Teisho will be on case 75 in the Book of Serenity, Ryan's Constant Principle. Introduction. Even as you call it thus, it's already changed. Where knowledge doesn't reach, avoid speaking of it. Here, is there any investigation or not? Case. Ryuan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? Yanto said, moving. Ryuan said, when moving, what then? Yanto said, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Ryuan stood there thinking. Yanto said, if you agree, you are not yet free of sense and matter. If you don't agree, you'll be forever sunk in birth and death. Verse. The round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body, resting on nothing, stands out unique and alive. To thank everybody for coming here this morning, and I particularly want to compliment a number of people who are here for a half day of meditation for the first time. A number of you came here this morning at 7 o'clock, and you've been sitting now for 4 hours, and are about to go through your next and final hour of the morning. And I want to say that you've all done a very, very good job. And I want to thank you for making such an excellent effort. Let me just say that if you can get through half a day of meditation like this, you can do 5 days or you can do 7 days. That's the truth. Our sesshin schedule is actually a little easier than our Saturday morning schedule. So even though we start later than we do at sesshin, we have no breakfast break. So we sit from 7 right until noon, basically with a few bathroom breaks. Whereas at sesshin, we would be breaking at 8 o'clock for breakfast, and then we wouldn't resume sitting again until 10. So, you know, you've been practicing, obviously, and you've been making an excellent effort, and it's really bearing fruit. You know, this is how things are accomplished in Zen. It's just little step at a time, little step at a time. And so, you know, people start sitting, and 20 minutes is very difficult to get through when they begin. And then after a while, it's possible to sit for half an hour or even 40 minutes without moving. And then the day comes when you can do an hour. And then the day comes when you can do half a day. And then, you know, the day comes when you can do a week. And so on. It's just a little, you know, really actually just one breath at a time, right? You just take care of the next moment. And if you do that, everything else falls into place. So I want to thank you very much for making such an excellent effort. It's really quite moving to see people making such good progress. So today's koan is Let me read it one more time, because it might not have made a whole lot of sense, which, as you will see, is a good thing, not a bad thing. Ryuan is a Zen practitioner at a temple, and so is Yanto. And Yanto is the senior practitioner, we could say. So Ryuan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? So he's, in a way, he could be saying something like this, you know, life is so crazy, and it's just so crazy and so transitory, right? You know, it's I'm pulled in this direction, and I'm pulled in that direction, and I'm pulled in this direction, and I don't know where to turn. Is there something that I can hold on to, or is there something that remains constant in the midst of all this craziness? What is the fundamental constant principle? So is there something in all of this that doesn't really change, that stays the same, that I can depend on and hold on to? Yanto basically says, yes, there is. The fundamental constant principle is moving. And then Ryuan says, well, okay, when it's moving, what then? And Yanto says, well, then, when it's moving, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Ryuan stood there thinking. In other words, he's a little bit at a loss, and doesn't know how to move forward. And Yanto says, if you agree with me, you are not free of sense and matter. In other words, you're still caught in distraction. If you don't agree, you'll be forever sunk in birth and death. So those are also considered conventionally not to be a good thing. So it's like, if you choose this answer, wrong. If you choose that answer, wrong. Okay. So that's the koan. What is there that I can hold on to? Moving. When it's moving, what is it? You can't see it when it's moving. And then he says, listen, if you agree with me, you don't have the answer. And if you disagree with me, you don't have an answer. So that's the koan. Let me explain, for those of you who are new to this occasion, the Teisho, that koans are rather strange texts, because they don't really operate the way normal texts do. Usually, what happens is that we sit down and read a book, and we often have a little pen or a marker in our hands to underscore the important points. And we try to hold on to what's being said in the book and evaluate it. We might agree or disagree, you know. The other day I was going through some old books of mine, and I was reading, actually, a book by an anthropologist named Levi Strauss. And at one time, I was really taken with Levi Strauss. And I was reading the book that I had owned as an undergraduate, which is more than 30 years ago. And he's a really smart man, you know, in my opinion. And I had all these sort of critical comments in the margin that were just sort of like very fresh, and you know, like, what a blockhead, what a stupid idea, you know. This is like funny now to me, because I realize you know, he's a pretty smart guy. He's not a blockhead, you know. But that's sort of like the little mind evaluating, right? It's kind of a critical mind. And it's looking for problems, right? Looking for a fight, you could say. And that's one way to approach texts. Another way to approach texts is to accept them like uncritically, right? Just to say, oh, this is the truth. try to just incorporate that into your life. This is often the way we behave with religious texts. But a koan isn't really either of those kinds of texts, and it doesn't really ask you to respond in either way. The point of a koan really isn't to make a set of claims or propositions, and it isn't really giving you like the Buddha Dharma as it should be understood. You know, this is like a scripture, a chapter and verse. Koans, as I've often said, work very much more like poetry. If you don't like poetry, I'm not sure this will be very satisfying, but my brother, for example, didn't like poetry. He didn't really like the arts. My brother was we came from the same parents, but we were very different. And I remember I took my brother once to the National Gallery in Washington, D.C., when we were living near Washington, because I used to like to go to the National Gallery on the weekends. And I love painting and the arts, and it's just my thing. So I dragged my brother in there once, and we were walking by a statue, a very beautiful statue by, I can't quite remember now, but I think it was an Italian Renaissance sculptor. And maybe Bellini. I think he also did paintings. But at any rate, it's a very famous scene called Hercules and Antaeus. Hercules is wrestling with this spirit of nature. And he beats nature by lifting the spirit of nature off the ground. And when Antaeus can't connect with the earth, he loses his power, and Hercules crushes him. It's kind of a sad myth. But anyway, it's very powerful sculpture. And I pointed to it, and I said, "Peter, look at this." And my brother looked at it very skeptically, and he said, "Oh, come on, nobody has muscles like that." Well, my brother didn't like poetry either, because he just thought, well, why doesn't the guy just say it? You know, why doesn't he just say it? And read it something, and it's hard to understand, and there's these strange images. Why doesn't he just say it? You know. But the point of poetry is really not to just say it, but to sort of give us a different set of eyes, right? And give us. I think we process poetry on a deeper level than just saying it. You know, it calls on us to operate on a more fundamental level, like not just the level of ideas and propositions, but you know, memory, sensation. We have experiential knowledge that we draw on when we make sense of a poem, you know, we use a lot more, actually, of our intelligence, I think, when we read a poem than when we read an article in the New York Times, a little news story, you know. The New York Times just says it, but the poem is really reaching more deeply into us, and it's getting a little deeper response, you know. Because sometimes I'll read about something in like politics in the New York Times, and I'll feel like crying, you know. But when I read a poem, I really feel like crying sometimes. It really moves me, you know. So there's something about a poem that operates on a deeper level, and koans are like that. You know, you don't have to really understand them with your discriminating mind. You want to sort of let them soak in. And when you work with koans in Zen practice, you have to be able to enter into a state of focused attention called samadhi. This is where your mind isn't racing all over the place, but it's watching the breath, and it's able to stay focused on the breath for a little while. And then you work with a koan, and the koan sort of sinks down into your unconscious, and it begins to transform you without you really being too aware of it. Koans, you could say, are a little sneaky. And basically, people who do a lot of Zen practice get very good at processing things on this deeper level. On this deeper level, processing information. And so koan is sort of training people to be, you could say, intuitive, right? But in the Western tradition, intuition is really really isn't very well understood. You know, people kind of trivialize intuition. You know, somebody might say, "Well, I'm using my intuition here." Everybody might think, "Well, that's not such a great idea." You know, but actually, people have a deep intelligence that they can draw on, and that's what the koan speaks to. So the koan is really asking a question. It's asking you to experience reality in a different way, and it's actually providing you sort of with tools to do that. I hope that helps understand. So this little story is talking about something we all feel. You know, what can I hold on to? What's the fundamental constant principle in life? See? And where is it? And the koan's a little disturbing because Ryuan comes to Yanto and he says, "What can I hold on to?" See? And I mean, this is Buddhism, so you would expect Yantu to turn and go, "You can hold on to the teachings of the Buddha. You know, you can take those to the bank," right? And he doesn't do that. "What can I hold on to?" And Yanto says, "Moving. Hold on to moving." And Ryoan says, "Well, if it's moving, what then?" He says, well, then you don't see it. See? And so on. So it's a kind of a frustrating conversation. So the proper way to listen to a Teisho like this is simply to watch your breath and focus on the breath and not worry too much about the content of the talk, because this isn't like an academic lecture. We're not going to experience this period of time using the part of our mind we would use if we were in a classroom. We're going to use the part of our mind that might be activated if we were listening to a poem or watching, looking out a window at a field, you know, that part of the mind. So you just want to keep bringing your attention back to your breath. And my job too is not particularly to deliver a coherent lecture, fortunately, because, you know, it's not going to be. Right? In fact, actually, you're not supposed to have any notes or. Basically, I came in here at 7 o'clock and started doing Zazen, working on this koan. And the talk that you're hearing now is coming out of that experience. So this is like a different way of experiencing reality. I've been reading a lot about the global warming situation, and I don't know about you, but I think it's quite quite serious, and I keep wondering how we got to where we are. You know, how we got to this current situation, because it does seem like there's something fundamentally wrong with the way we've been living. You know. And I know that everybody who has a way of life or a philosophy or a commitment in life, you know. Maybe is now saying, "Well, you know, my particular way of life, my particular philosophy has an answer to this problem." But I really do believe that there's something special about Zen right at this moment in history. You know? Because I really do think Zen is about how to live a more natural life, using a bigger part of our minds. I was going through some notes this last week on my teacher, Genki Roshi, and I came across a little bio of Genki Roshi, and his teacher was a man named Yamamoto Genpo Roshi. Yamamoto Genpo Roshi. And I hadn't really recalled any of these details, but it was very interesting. Yamamoto Genpo Roshi was born at the turn of the century in Japan, in a very poor, actually he was an orphan, as it turns out. And he was adopted by a very poor family. And he had a very difficult upbringing. And it turns out that his father was, abusive, physically abusive person. And Yamamoto was, as a result, not very well-developed human being in the early part of his life. Apparently, his father left a lot of psychological scars on him. And fortunately, his mother was a very kind woman, very compassionate person, and inspired him to give him something to hold on to, something, an example of goodness or something. Anyway, when he was about 20, he began to develop a degenerative eye disease. And after a while, he lost pretty much all of his eyesight and entered a Zen temple and really couldn't, never really developed intellectually because of his vision problems and his very difficult early life. But he became very famous Zen teacher in his later life, and he lived to be like 98 years old, quite an old person. Anyway, I was going through some of these papers that I have about my teacher, and my teacher Genki Roshi was a student of Yamamoto Genpo Roshi, and I was reading this little bio of Yamamoto Genpo Roshi. And I was thinking about a natural world and the sort of crisis we're in and how we've gotten to where we are. And I came across this phrase, which I'm going to try to read. It's Japanese. Maybe Yurio can assist me. Maybe not. Okay. Where are you, Uriel? Okay. Maybe this makes sense to you if I read it. Banzo Shichu Doku Roshin. Is that pronounced right? Banzo Shichu Doku Roshin. It's supposed to mean in the myriad forms a single body is revealed. Does that make any sense? No. Okay. Well, take my word for it. I think that many of our problems have to do with consciousness, you know, with how we've gotten to where we are as a civilization. It has to do with our mental habits. And I think we all have a mind, we've all developed a mind which is desperately looking for something to hold on to. I think that we have, as a result, developed a kind of distrustful mind. Part of Zen practice is overcoming that, just working through that distrustful mind. My brother passed away about a year ago, almost a year ago today, from cancer. And I know that his kids are having a very hard time with that experience. I was talking to my sister-in-law about it the other day. And my sister was also telling me that my nephews have really not adjusted. And I think that when people have that kind of an experience, they develop an attitude towards the world which is, they're hurt, injured by life. And they develop a kind of distrustful attitude towards things, you know. I think it takes many different forms. My niece, one of the things she said to me during the funeral was that she was just shocked that my brother wasn't going to be around for the rest of her life, that when she thought about the future, she thought that my brother would be there at her college graduation, would be there at her wedding, be there for the birth of her children. And it just shocked her to no end that he wasn't going to be around. And she kept saying, I thought he would be there. And I think we all have experiences like that in life. You know, we start out with a certain kind of plan, and something goes wrong, and we become distrustful. And I think this happens to pretty much everybody in life, right? And as this process is repeated over and over again, I think we get to be very, very detached from the real world, from the world we actually live in. And we start living more and more in a kind of a safety, mental safety zone. And I wonder, there's no way to know, but I wonder if maybe part of our problem with the natural environment is that we have this, we go through this psychological process as we grow up of sort of withdrawing more and more from the world, withdrawing more and more and more until the world is quite abstract. The actual world is quite abstract, and we live in this kind of world of symbols and ideas and goals like to be famous or to be rich or something like that. I wonder if there's a connection between our sort of crisis and personal choices that we all make. There's a 6 billion of us, we're all going through these experiences where someone we love dies in the middle of our youth, and we withdraw, or you know, you get on your motorcycle on an autumn day and you hit a deer and you're in traction for a year. You know, this happened to somebody in our group. All of this, you know, individual experiences multiplied many times create like a global situation, right? I really believe this. So I think that somehow, you know, as we grow up, we develop this this distrust of life, and it translates into kind of a withdrawal from the world, the natural world. And I just think this happens to people. When I was growing up, my nephew, or rather my cousin, had a dog that he just loved. And this dog, my cousin had this obsession with dogs when he was a little kid. And he wanted a dog. He was like, he dreamed of getting a dog, and he hounded my uncle and aunt about getting the dog. And they finally gave in and bought him a dog. And he had a picture of a dog in his room, you know, this sort of thing. And he had books on dogs. And he slept with his dog, you know. My cousin used to go in the woods with his dog and come home and pick the ticks out of his dog's coat. And then, you know, they'd sleep together on the bed. I mean, this was the way they lived, you know. And and my brother also had a dog and was a big dog lover. But anyway, I got to know my cousin quite well when I was a kid, and I knew he loved his dog, and they had this close, passionate relationship. Right? You know? I mean, literally, when we would go to visit Uncle John and Aunt Joan, you know, Jeff would be in bed with the dog, you know, at night. And my brother was like that too. We had a collie, and you know, the collie would just get in bed and lie down with his paws sticking out, and my brother would put his arm around his dog. It's great, right? And anyway, many, many years later, I wasn't really as an adult, I didn't really keep in contact with my cousin. But for a while he lived in Woodbridge. He now lives in North Carolina. But he got through school, and he went to Montclair State University, and he got out, and he was a businessman. He actually was in auto parts. And he had a rough time, you know, because he built up a very profitable territory selling auto parts. And then they transferred him to a very poor area, a place that sales were very poor. And he works, you know, on a commission basis. So he took a big hit in his income, and he developed a drinking problem. That sounds familiar. Anyway, I went to visit him at one point, and he had a dog, what do you know? But he had the dog outside in a doghouse outside. And I said, Jeff, aren't you going to bring your dog? He says, no, the dog doesn't come in the house. I swear this is true. So the dog doesn't come in the house. And so he had a dog, but the dog wasn't allowed in the house because the dogs are too messy, right? And I just think this is like something happened to my cousin growing up that changed the way he interacted with the world, you know? And I mean, I am not a trained psychoanalyst, right? But I don't think it takes a trained psychoanalyst to see that he's really not trusting life anymore, you know? I really believe that. And so you take my cousin, who used to love to go into the woods and romp around with his dogs, and they'd both come back and look over their bodies for ticks. You know? He'd watch TV and pull the ticks out of the dog's fur, right? That's a memory.
And it
and he's an adult. He's about my age. He's in his 50s. And he has a dog, but he doesn't allow the dog in the house. The dog's too dirty. You could say, well, that's just growing up, but I don't think so. Multiply that by 6 billion, and maybe you have the situation we have today. So, you know, I think this Zen thing is very, very important. You and I are just individual people, you know, and if you practice Zen, it's not going to save the world necessarily, but it may really change the way you personally interact with the world, because I think Zen has a lot to do with experiencing the world in a way that you might have experienced it when you were a little kid, you know. It's not like going back to childhood, but I do think that children have a kind of openness to life that we lose growing up, you know, that we lose a kind of openness. You know, when you're, I think part of the reason we lose that openness is because our mental world gets smaller and smaller and smaller, you know. Maybe part of this is education, you know, not just personal embarrassments and injuries and accidents that happen to us. But I also think that, you know, our mental lives are very restrictive. You know, when we experience life intellectually, you know, it's I would say very, very narrow kind of very limited experience of the world. I don't think you should drop out of college, you know, I'm not saying that, please understand. You know. We gain a lot by using the discriminating mind, right? A lot. But it's very narrow kind of intelligence. And there's a deeper intelligence. You know, there's a deeper intelligence. It's not a verbal, necessarily a verbal mind. But we encounter that when we sit on the cushion. You know, sometimes you come to Zen practice and something has gone right in your life or something hasn't, you know. And you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath. And little by little, your relationship to the world really starts to change. And if you sit there long enough, you begin to open up. And you begin to feel connected to things. Now, at the end of an evening of meditation, we have tea and a cookie. And I don't know about you, but for me, that tea and that cookie are like heaven itself, right? And it's really because I've been sitting in a state of attentive presence for an hour and a half. And I eat that cookie and I drink that tea, and it's just so delicious because actually I'm so connected, that natural connectedness. It's like the natural state of connectedness has returned. And people sometimes after sitting, you know, you go outside and you see something, the moon, or you see a tree, and this automatic sense of connectedness. Yeah? My teacher, Genki Roshi, was training in Ryotakuji, and they were doing Sesshin, and he was only 12 years old when he started doing Sesshin. Some of you have been to Sesshin. And I don't think you would have wanted to be there when you were 12, yeah, necessarily. But Genki, like Yamamoto Roshi, was adopted. He was an orphan. And he was adopted by Yamamoto Roshi. And so he grew up pretty much in a temple. And when he was 12 years old, he was doing seven-day sesshin. And Yamamoto Roshi expected him to be just like any other monk at 12 years old, you know, so he had to sit there full lotus every sit. That's how they do it, or did it, I guess. So Genki Roshi, really, I don't think 12-year-old kids should do Zazen myself, but Genki Roshi was doing it, and he was not very happy. And in pain, and so on, and he went into the outhouse and to relieve himself. And in a Zen outhouse, there's an altar by the toilet. They don't really have a toilet. They have a hole in the floor. And but there's an altar with the flowers and incense and Buddha, because we civilized people forget the body. We're socialized into a very alienated relationship to our body, but body functions are sacred, right? Everything is Buddha. You know? So next to the outhouse, in the outhouse next to the toilet, is an altar. And anyway, Genki was pulling up his robe to take a pee-pee, and he looked over at the flowers, right? And he just burst into tears. Because the flowers were his true self. This is like deep experience. The flowers were the true self. That was the beginning of his Zen practice, right? His real Zen practice, that moment of connection with the world. Have to work, we adults in modern society have to work very hard to have that experience usually. Now, sometimes it happens spontaneously. You know, you just step outside one summer night and you look up at the setting sun and you just disappear into the moment, right? You feel your kinship or connectedness to everything. And this is not a fantasy. It's not fantasy. It's how things really are, really so. Now, intellectually, we know everything is interconnected. We know this intellectually. You know, all over the world, people understand intellectually that we have a crisis and so on. But experientially, you could say, in terms of how we think and experience the world, existentially, you know, how we relate to the world, very alien. And there's all kinds of reasons for that. They're easily understood. But, this Zen practice is about moving beyond that alienation. You know, returning to our original state. So, somebody like Yamamoto Genpo Roshi had grown up like a really rough life. Right, you know, many injuries, many blows. His father used to beat him. You know, didn't send him to school. Right? Went blind in the early 20s. You know, what a raw deal, right? And somehow he stumbles into Zen temple in Japan. And by the way, not a Zen genius, right? You know, he came to Zen when he was in his 20s. He was still struggling with his koans when he was in his 50s, right? So some people complain because they've been spending a year or two on a koan, you know. Yamamoto Genpo, this blind, illiterate man, was sitting in a Zen temple for 30 years trying to wake up. And he'd go in to see his teacher every day, and the teacher would say, "I'm sorry, you don't have the answer to your koan." Right? And he'd go back and go, "Boo-hoo-hoo, you know, poor little me," right? One day, goes to the bath, maybe he too, you know, goes, maybe it always happens in the bathroom. Goes somewhere, sees something, hears something. The Zen stories, you know, we have all these stories of people having this experience. You know, enlightenment is a sense of deep sense of connectedness to life. So, you know, there's a story about a Zen master who had been training for 25 years and getting nowhere with his koan, and he left. He said, "That's it. I gave you 25 years of my life, not a minute more." Right? So he leaves the temple, and he's a monk, so he doesn't have any skills, you know, he doesn't have any, so he's living up in a mountain hut. And, scraping by. And one day he's raking with his bamboo rake, he's raking the dirt in front of his hut, and a little pebble flies up in the air and hits a piece of bamboo. And he hears that, and boom, right? It's like what happened to Genki in the outhouse. This is real, this is a famous Zen story. And different people, happens to them different ways. And you know, it's not like one time and that's it, you know. Because of the injuries we suffer in growing up, we become more and more distanced from this world which we're a part of. And we have, if we are lucky or if we practice Zen, we have these moments where we open up again. We know this is true, this I'm really connected to everything. And, you know, basically habit is very powerful, right? So, you know, after Genki left the outhouse, he went back to the Zendo and his whole life was a little tiny bit different, but not totally different. He kept practicing and having more of those experiences. And little by little, you know, turned into a different kind of person. Every time that happens to you, it's like opening your world a little bigger. And your world can get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, in my opinion. And same thing with Yamamoto Roshi, you know, sitting in a temple, blind man, practicing in a temple, you know, going through these experiences again and again. And when he's 90 years old, he says, "Banzo Shichu Doku Roshin," which I guess could mean anything. It may not even be Japanese. But it's supposed to mean, "In the myriad forms, a single body is revealed." So a single body is revealed. That's your body. It's my body. See, I mean, this is not a philosophical proposition, right? I mean, intellectually, we already know you can't have trees without water. You can't have water without the atmosphere, and so on. We know that. But experientially, we're very distanced, very frightened, very detached. No. If you sit on the cushion long enough, you begin to have these experiences where you feel yourself, your boundaries dropping away, this sense of connection. And it's beautiful. It's wonderful. And it begins to be so obvious that this world, this whole world, is your one body. This whole world is your one body, and everything in it is your body. And by the way, my body is your body, you know, and your body is my body. And this ground is my body. You know, this is the way Zen people experience the world after a while. You know. Ryuan asked Yanto, "What is the fundamental constant principle? What can I hold on to?" Yanto said, "It's moving, because it's alive. It's this, everywhere your mind rests is the one body. Everywhere your attention alights is the one body. And it's moving all the time, but it's always the same. Moving all the time, but always the same body." Right? But, you know, we're scared. We're all so scared, you know. Because I want to hold on, I want to be safe, and so on. But, you know, the nature of this one body is it's alive. Always changing, you know, always unfolding. Nothing's ever the same. What is the fundamental constant principle? What can I hold on to? Yanto says, life. please hold on to this world, right? And Ryoan said, when it's moving, what then? You don't see the fundamental constant principle. Ryoan stood there thinking. He's not there yet, see? He's in a quandary. He's trying to figure it out with his discriminating mind. And you can't do it. See, I believe this so deeply, that we human beings can't free ourselves from our current problems by continuing to use the small mind, the discriminating mind. You know, we have all the discursive knowledge we need to see that something's wrong, but it hasn't changed anything because of the way we experientially interact with the world. Yeah. So fortunately, we have this deeper intelligence, you know. And if we tap into that over and over again, really becomes, you become a different person, I become a different person. That's just about all we can do, you know. But you multiply that by, it doesn't have to be 6 million or 6 billion, right? You know, a couple people like that in every crowd could make a real difference. What is the fundamental constant principle? Moving. When it's moving, what then? You don't see it. Ryoan stood there thinking. Yanto said, if you agree, he said, don't use your discriminating intellect. Use your big mind. If you agree, you're wrong. If you disagree, you're wrong. It's not about agree, disagree. It's about this experience of a deeper connection. So, verse. The round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. See, having no edges. No boundaries. Right? Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body resting on nothing stands out unique and alive. That's what we Zen people are experiencing, the free body resting on nothing, no boundary. Banzo Shichu Doku Roshin. Everywhere you turn, it's the one body. It's an intellectually dubious proposition. But sit on the cushion, watch your breath, and it will begin to happen. And it's the most wonderful thing in the world. In the myriad forms, a single body is revealed.